All right, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are on the Asian Highway. Welcome back to week 8 of season 5. This is the Storytellers Action Podcast. I'm your host, Pimo, going solo today. All our best wishes to our other co-hosts, Devesh Das and Feral Khan, who will not be here this week. We will welcome back when they're back in studio with us in our remote studios. As usual with this quarantine COVID edition, we are remotely recording. And today's guest, our 8th guest of this season, is David Paul Francis. He is a television writer and actor, well, multiple writer forms of writing, I guess we could say. We'll talk about that in a few minutes as this episode progresses. If you watched Hemlock Grove on Netflix in the early days of the platform, he was a writer for that series. He is also on a few other shows, which I'll let him mention. I think one was a Batman-themed one, Superman-themed one. And why don't you clarify that? It's Krypton, right?
Yes. Yeah. We did 2 seasons of Krypton. It was a really terrific show for Warner Brothers and Sci-Fi. Unfortunately, it got canceled after 2 seasons. Unjustly so, I think. I think it was a really good show, and I think they made a huge mistake because it was so much fun to write for that show.
And now you're working on American Gods. Is that what's going
on? Yeah, I just finished up the 3rd season of American Gods. It's going to be pretty epic. I was on it for an entire year. I was an executive producer or writer for the show. And so I finished that up in April of this year. And I'd been working on it since April of the previous year. So it was an entire calendar year. And I just finished that up. I came back to the States. I spent 5 months in Toronto producing episodes. Came back, and then, of course, we were immediately on quarantine and lockdown, so I've been sequestered in my home and trying to stay safe and masking up and getting all my groceries delivered and trying to, weather the storm like everybody else. In the early days, you know, the fight for toilet paper was real.
Yes.
The struggle was real. And, so just now recently I've taken a new job, but it looks like American Gods will be, I don't know if I'm breaking any news here, but it looks like, I can't give specific dates, but the early part of next year, I think, is when the 3rd season will drop, and we're very, very excited about it, because I think it's going to be really great. Worked with some really terrific people.
Sweet. I want to give some context before we dive into the rest of our conversation. This is not the first time you and I have been on a show together. In fact, you were a co-host of mine, I want to say 7 years ago.
Yep.
Maybe and 8 years. That was those 7, I think 2013.
Yeah, I think it was right before I actually started Hemlock Grove. It wasn't too...
And that was exactly what I want to mention is we were on the other end of your writing career at the start of it.
No, we're right at the beginning. Yes, hadn't even started. Things were pretty intense at that time because I had lost my survival job and I was just writing on my own. I didn't know what was going to happen, and then fortunately, I was fortunate enough to get my first writing job, and I've been lucky enough to have been writing and working ever since. So, complete turnaround. So it was really nice.
Nice. Well, I want to reminisce a little more because That was a Bollywood show that I had in Long Beach. And the show that you were on that you helped me co-host was, we had a guest named Matai. She was a singer from
LA. Oh, yeah, really talented.
Yeah, we had a conversation with her. And before we had her on the call in the show, you and I were having a chat about your nickname. And it was Dave O'Clock.
Dave O'Clock. Always Dave O'Clock.
What, you want to give a little context to where that name came from or what that name means?
It's a little embarrassing, but sure. It was in college. I did my undergraduate work at University of California, California State University of Chico, where the only 4.0 you can find is on a blood alcohol level test. So I did a lot of partying back then. So I was a little crazy. So whenever it was time to drink, everybody would say, "What time is it?" And I'd say, "It's Dave O'Clock." And that just became the thing. That was, we all had these like weird little nicknames, and that was mine. So,
yeah. Well, I have a similar history with my nickname, Pimo.
Yeah, Pimo
came from college as well. Yeah, that came from UCLA, and that was a misinterpretation of my name.
Really?
I was at a frat party. My best friend lived in a frat, and I, of course, would hang out with him at his frat and during the parties they would have there at the house. And this was a Hispanic frat. It's called Theta Delta Chi. About 90% of the brothers in the frat were of Hispanic or Latin descent. And my friend was one of the few Indians who were in there. And so one night at a party, he introduces me to one of his brothers. His name was Tony. And my friend, despite being Indian, could not say my name. He could not say Parimal. He would say like Parimal or something. He completely contorted my name to something that was unrecognizable. And of course, when the music's loud and people are tipsy and drunk, and you hear a really name that's a really weird, quote unquote, weird name that's mispronounced, you're not going to say it right in response. And so he somehow heard Parimal as Pimo. And that's what he thought my name was, really. That was my real name to him. And of course, he remembered that. So every time he saw me on campus, he would say, "Hey, Pimo." And of course, other people would hear it and that knew us. And next thing you know, everyone's calling me Pimo.
Right.
That also stuck. And that was, 23, 24 years ago.
Wow.
And it's been there ever since. And so I could relate. I've had a similar
experience. Yeah. It's not too many people call me, and not too many people know about that. It's just that group back from my college days. But it's fun to bring it back around.
Yeah. So since the day we were last in studio together, you have done a lot. Tell us and walk us through.
Sure.
Just because you have to do a transition. The other context was you weren't a writer before per se.
Acting was, you know, that was my life. That was my job. I got my MFA in acting from UC Irvine, and right. So I was an actor for 16 years before I made the shift into writing, and it was. I primarily did it because, you know, I thought I had no intention of being a writer, like none. I felt like homework. Like if you'd said, yeah, you're going to be a writer someday, I went, oh God, that sounds horrible. That's so much work. But it was so hard, you know, I'd had success as an actor. I'd done some films and I'd done TV and I did a lot of regional theater, but I could never quite make a living at it, like just a sustainable income. I always had to take survival jobs. It was always, you know, having to do that. And so it was really difficult. So I decided one day with a friend, hey, you know, why don't I write a show for myself? Or why don't we write a show about this awful place that we work at? And so I said, why not? Let's try that. So I just started teaching myself how to structure a script. I read some books. But I also realized, too, that I actually had some kind of intrinsic knowledge of it because of my acting background, because I understood scripts. I'd read so many. I was also, you know, in college, I was one of the captains of my speech and debate team. So I understood structure of beginning, middle, and end, and three-act structure. So I just started, you know, learning how to do it. And I wrote a script, and a friend of mine read it, who's a novelist, and they thought it was really funny. It was a comedy script. It was just a half-hour comedy script called Living the Dream. And they said, hey, you have some talent at this, so why don't you keep doing it? So I just kept writing more comedy scripts, and you know, long story short, it eventually turned into, I started writing one-hour dramas. I wrote a one-hour drama. And it was a show called God's Work that was about how, it was about a psychologist that treated Marines and sailors for PTSD. And so I did a lot of research. I interviewed a lot of vets and a lot of psychologists. And, you know, I thought I was going to, you know, I was this comedy guy. And it turned into this very dark 1 hour. My friend read it, and he loved it. And he took it to his manager, and they then signed me. And long story short, in about 6 months, I got, I signed with CAA. They read that script. The script got optioned. And then a little bit after that, I got hired on my first job, which was Hemlock Grove. And so I did 2 seasons of Hemlock Grove. I did a season of a show called Powers, which is a superhero show based on the comics by Brian Bendis. And then I did 2 seasons of Krypton, which was a lot of fun. And then I just did a season of American Gods. And now I just signed on to do to co-executive produce and write for a new show at HBO Max called Redbird Lane. And it's in development. Well, we don't have a series pickup yet, but we are, you know, putting together scripts and developing it, and hopefully we'll get there. So yeah, so it's been quite a journey since we last talked, and the last time we were together. I've been busy, man.
And busy is good, especially in context of the world we're living in now, and you know, the ups and downs of the COVID era. I know you've had a few months off. How did you occupy yourself during the past 6 months?
Man, I gotta be honest, it's been really hard. I think like the first month or so, first month and a half, maybe two, it was kind of, it felt, you know, there was a novelty to it. It was like, well, I mean, there was this, you know, you're scared because it's like, holy shit, there's this virus going around. So I'm just, you know, locked in the house, but I needed the rest. I was really tired from doing that show. It was a lot of work, and I needed sort of the mental kind of rest from that. But COVID has been, I think it's just the isolation. I don't see many people. You know, I live alone. I live by myself. I'm not married. I don't have kids. So I don't have like a pod or anything that I hang out. You know, it's just me. I get all my groceries delivered now. I, you know, take out. I try not to go places if I don't have to go there. So it's been very isolating. And I think there's a sense of anxiety and kind of low, at least for me anyway, like a low grade depression that kind of sets in, because those days where you just, I mean, you forget what day it is. You know, it was a miracle if I could just shower and put on pants. You know, it was like, oh, victory. But it was hard. You know, I've been very fortunate. Like, financially, I didn't have to worry because of what I do. So that was a real blessing. And I know people are really struggling right now. And I've been one of the fortunate ones that I can sort of wait it out at home. So I'm very cognizant of that and very grateful for that. But it's been hard. And I think it's like everybody I've talked to, Pimo, has really struggled with, I think, the isolation and just the general anxiety of, like, this year has been a, you know, pardon my French, a shit show of, you know, bad news and difficulty, you know, from the fires to the deaths of people that we really admire. You know, Kobe Bryant, you know, when he passed away January 26th, that sort of set the tone, you know, for what this year was going to be like.
Well, if you do the math, today is the 8-month anniversary.
It's
September 26th. Yeah, 8 months. Yeah. And it feels like 8 years, to be honest. I mean, that's how bad this year's been. I mean,
yeah. You
know, it just, and, you know, obviously complicating. I guess this is a question in the format of a statement. I would say this year, it's already been a tough, it would have been a tough year in normal circumstances because it's an election year. And all the emotions that have built up over the past 4 years are starting to spill out now, right? And we're what, 30-some days away from the election? So we're getting pretty close. And all the emotions that are attached to the election are already there and would have been there regardless of what happened this year. And I would say the existence of COVID, the passings of people like Kobe Bryant and Chad Bozeman and, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Oh, my goodness.
Are only heightening the emotions. I mean, would you say that's the case? Like, it's not enough, but now we have all this stuff. Now it's making us spill over to a point of we don't know if we can handle this.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think of, like, people like John Lewis, you know, who have passed away this year. I mean, just like
another name, yeah.
Icons, you know, of civil rights, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg for, you know, gender equality. Mm-hmm. And again, people that you idolize, like Kobe Bryant. I mean, you know, you and I talked about that a lot. It's
right.
You know, Kobe was Kobe, and being us living in LA, it was like he's like, you know, the de facto mayor of this town. I mean, there's so much love for Kobe. And to have somebody like that who you just viewed as being indestructible was difficult to. I was in Canada when it happened, and, you know, I cried. I was devastated. And, it, you know, it was. Even people up there were like walking around like, holy shit, did you hear what happened? And,
yeah.
But more though, you know, even, you know, those deaths were, you know, tragic. But also, you know, the death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. I mean, their murders were, you know, sparked such social unrest, much needed social unrest. And, you know, the fact that we need to confront racial inequality that's been swept under the rug, you know, in this country for, well, since its inception, really. It's something that people don't want to look at, and now they're being forced to. And it's hard for people, you know, I think especially white people, to confront the, you know, the systematic racism that has been built into the pie of America, that's been baked into the pie of America. And that adds so much, you know, we have this undercurrent of that going on along with the election, which I think is, has made everything feel so heavy and feel so dire and important. But, you know, all these things need to be addressed and looked at. And, you know, there has to be a reckoning. And I feel like that's kind of what we're barreling towards with this election.
Yeah, and you know, we're talking today a few days after the grand jury out in Louisville had issued its indictment, and you know, there were three officers involved with the Breonna Taylor case, the murder of a young woman, and you know, only one of them got indicted, and that indictment was a wanton endangerment. As LeBron James said, the wall of her apartment received more justice than Breonna Taylor did. And so I kind of want to share, get your thoughts of, you know, of the indictment and, you know, to kind of compliment what we just said a minute ago about the system, and just what do you think happened and how can we fix it?
Yeah, I mean, everything that I've read, now, again, you know, I wasn't there or anything like that, but everything that I read and understand about this case seems to me that the police completely fucked up. They went in there. There was one person who said that the police announced themselves. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But in any case, I've had the experience of waking up and having police in my house. This actually happened to me.
Oh, okay.
And they, let me just kind of set this up if you don't mind. I'll tell you my
story. Please do. Yeah.
I'll tell you how I sort of see it. So I was asleep one night and I was living in North Hollywood. I sleep with earplugs in because I had to get up early for a survival job. My roommate had just moved out. I was getting ready to move to the west side, so the apartment didn't have a lot of furniture in it. Anyway, I'm sleeping, and all of a sudden, I see these lights underneath my bed, coming through my bedroom door. Now, me being me, the first thought I have is, oh my God, I'm about to be abducted by aliens. Because I'm just like, that's who I am. But then I can sort of hear voices, and I take out my earplugs and I hear, is anybody in here? Da 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 da. I didn't hear the word cops. I didn't hear anything like that. I just hear, is anybody in here? Da 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 da. And then as I'm like kind of scrambling to put on a robe and, you know, I didn't, you know, I was going to grab my my bat, like I had a bat. And then I heard, it's LAPD, da da da. So I, you know, put the bat down and I opened my bedroom door and there's four cops standing there with guns on me.
Wow.
So let me tell you, if I had had that bat in my hand, I probably would have been dead.
Yeah.
And here are these people entering my place, right? I had no idea until they were in and saying LAPD that they were there, right? So to relate this to Breonna Taylor is that her boyfriend, in my opinion, had every right to defend their home. He didn't know what was happening. I don't think he knew that they were cops. You know, he thought that they were probably burglars and intruders. And how does he, how, just because you say you're a cop doesn't mean you're a cop.
Yeah.
You know, and then they just started firing willy-nilly. And I, from what I understand too, like the warrant was completely, they were at the wrong place. You know, they were somebody botched it all up. There was nobody there that they were looking for. And to say that they acted within the scope of the law and that Breonna Taylor's, you know, death is somehow justified, I think is absolute bullshit. That's my take on it.
So if I could add to what you just said, the early morning after the indictment, I'm talking like 2 a.m. I couldn't sleep. And so I came here to my office, my home office, and set up my podcast production. And I gave an 18-minute monologue of my thoughts of what happened. And the theme of what I said was very similar to what you just said, in that if you could use the system to justify what happened, you are proof that the system is fucked up, that the system is broken, right? Because we should not be living in a system that allows for this to happen.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And if we want to take the words of the preamble of the Constitution seriously, where, you know, in order to create a more perfect union, then we need to be working towards perfecting our laws. And that's what we should be doing now. We shouldn't be bickering about the technicality or whether this was racist act or not. The system screwed up, whether you like it or not. And then, it allowed this to happen.
Exactly. And apparently, like, one of the cops that was involved in that had a history of being shuttled around from, like, department to department because he had, you know, had complaints against him for excessive use of force and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, so where's the accountability? Where is the, I don't, you know, it's, that's what's so maddening about it, because I really feel that there are, you know, justice isn't equal in this country. You know, there are two systems of justice, for the very wealthy and the very privileged, and for everybody else.
You know what's ironic about that, David, is there are a lot of people who are in the second category, the everybody else category, who are defending the system as working, even though it's working for the people who are not in the same category as them.
Exactly. Exactly. And I, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, I think we need a police force? I do. I think that I...
We should all agree on that, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there are, of course that there are good cops. Anybody says that they're not, I mean, that's bullshit.
Right.
There are good cops, but it's the system that is fundamentally flawed.
Right.
And the way that they are trained that is fundamentally flawed. And the way that they are trained to think about the citizenry is completely fundamentally flawed. They view us, I think, as the enemy. And it is not saying all of them do, again, but it's systematic. It's built into the cake, or it's baked. I keep saying that. It's baked.
Yeah, baked in the cake, yes. I want to bring up two little example anecdotes to kind of complement all this. Did you watch the film El Camino, the Breaking Bad film?
No, you know, I haven't seen it. Okay.
Well, there's a relevant scene, and I'll just describe it. So, you know, the film, for general context, literally starts from the minute after the Breaking Bad series ends. Mm-hmm. So it's basically chronicling Jesse Pinkman's post-enslaved life. You know, he's freed from at the end of the show, and now he's in a bit of a bind. He's on the run. There's some flashback scenes to what happened, you know, what happened during Breaking Bad. But there's a scene where he's visiting an apartment, and he's actually broken into an apartment. And it's because there's his money of his that he had saved up hidden in this apartment, and he's trying to find the money.
Mm-hmm.
And while he's in this apartment, two people that are cops, and I say that with air quotes, come into the apartment. You know, they're saying they're searching. They're really security guards from somewhere else. They're not cops at all. During this whole scene, they're being portrayed as cops, but you as a viewer, you're questioning, like, you sense something's wrong, and you're just waiting for that reveal to happen. And finally, at the end of the scene, is the reveal happens that, oh my God, and the revelation happens through Jesse Pinkman when he realizes, wait a second, you guys really aren't cops. And you guys have been lying to me this whole time about breaking this apartment as private individuals, not as cops, with a fake warrant. And I bring that up is because to your point earlier, you said it's like, you know, when the cops came into Breonna Taylor's apartment, how do we know for sure if they're cops?
Exactly.
How do you know? Right? You don't know. And here are literally tier two white men who pose themselves as cops, and the other person in the apartment believed it for a good 20 minutes. Right?
That's exactly right.
And you never know. That's one point. And the other point is, you know, to the people that say, well, Breonna Taylor deserved what happened because her boyfriend had shot at the cops, everything would be fine. Those same people, I guarantee you this, David, and you're free to tell me if I'm wrong or not, but this is one of the points I'm going to make is,
sure,
had that been a white person using a gun as self-defense for a break-in, that would be the defense. Like, you come into my place, I have the right to defend myself with a gun, I will shoot first. How many times have pro-gun proponents said just that? You come into my apartment, shoot first, ask questions later.
That's exactly right. It's a completely double standard. And, you know, the thing that's so becomes so apparent, I don't think to us, but to white Americans in general, is that being, you know, a person of color, and especially being black, it's like what we see now is like, or, you know, what, you know, I think black people have understood for, you know, since the time that they've been here, is that just by being black, you're considered a threat, that you're armed, or that there's all these presumptions about who you are and, you know, the threat level that you present. And it's horrifying. I mean, it's just horrifying. It's, whereas a white person doesn't have that, there is not that level of threat that's imbued on them, you know, that the culture puts on them. And it's a whole different world. And I think it's interesting, you know, as brown guys, we kind of operate in the middle there somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, I've been pulled over many times for being, you know, in a crappy car in a rich neighborhood that people didn't think I belonged in. And you know why it's happening, you know, it's because of the color of your skin, you know, that's why they're pulling you over. So anybody that thinks that doesn't happen, or that systematic racial profiling isn't a thing, that, man, I'm here to tell you, it's a thing, and it's a real thing. Doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah, and all this entire season, I've been sharing personal anecdotes of my interactions with various forms of authority and just various people in general. The one story I haven't shared yet, this is it's a short story, but it happened. It was the summer of 1998. I just graduated from college, and I'm about 2 weeks away from starting law school. And so my mom and my sister and I decided to take a vacation before law school started. And so we flew to D.C. And then from D.C. we did a road trip to Toronto. So, you know, stopped over in New York, stopped over in Philadelphia, stopped over in Buffalo, stopped over in Pittsburgh. Those are all the cities we went along the way at some point. And so it was D.C. to New York, with the stop in Philly, and then New York to Buffalo, Toronto. And then we stayed in Toronto for 5 days. And then on the return trip back, we're driving back. So now we're going around the lake, come around the bend, and we're entering Buffalo. So we're still in Canada, just about to cross the border. And, you know, it's relatively easy. If anybody's done the border crossing at US-Canada, it's relatively easy to go from US into Canada. It's pretty quick. But coming back isn't as quick. And so we're at the border, and we're going to give our passports to the agent. And we start getting grilled and lectured and questioned about everything about who we are by this agent. And why are you entering the United States? Do you see our passports? We're citizens. Are these real? Yes, they are.
Yes.
Where do you live? And what do you do for a living? And it's not like the guy's tone was yelling at us. It wasn't like he was having a conversation with us. If he was talking the tone that you and I are talking right now, I might have been a lot more open to it. I would have at least found some innocence in it. But this guy's yelling at us. You can literally see his face is turning red in anger.
What year was this female?
1998.
Jesus.
Yeah, so almost at the turn of the century. And, you know, I'm 21, 22 years old. You know, my mom's in her 40s. Mom's about my age, where I'm at now. And, you know, so, you know, I'm old enough to understand what's going on. I'm going to law school, so I'm already in the mindset of civil rights and law.
Right.
My mom has been here since the 70s, and this is not her first rodeo. She's been through quite a bit herself. So to her, this is like yawn again, right? You know, so, you know, this is not something that's new to her. She's experiences in other forms. And we were just like nodding our heads, like we're just coming back into our home country. I mean, we're in Buffalo, not LA, but it's still the United States. This is where we live. We're citizens. I'm born here. My sister's born here. We're as American as anybody else. And
yeah, exactly. I mean, but that's the thing, man. It's like, it doesn't, you know, it's, to a lot of people, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't matter. You're still a foreigner. You know, you're an American. You were born here. And to a lot of people, because of the color of your skin and your ethnicity, you don't quite fit in.
Yeah, and so I actually want to ask you this question. It's I'm going to try to phrase it right. You know, this whole acceptance thing is interesting because it seems like the one way that certain people will be willing to accept us is if we fall under the moniker of the model minority, right?
Sure. I mean,
we hear this a lot of like, if we just play by what the rules that they want and, you know, the model minority rules, we'll be fine. Everything will be okay. Just be the model. Be this hardworking group that does all this great stuff and doesn't say shit. You don't fight back. Just work and be quiet about it. Put your heads down and work. And I just kind of want to get your thoughts on like just how demeaning that is to not just to you, but to us as a population. And how that really disrespects us as people.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, I want to say this just sort of up front. It's like we wouldn't have the opportunities that we have if it wasn't for what African Americans have gone through before us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we owe, I think, as, you know, people of color and people that have, you know, I'm an immigrant. I was born in Africa. Came here in 1970. But the groundwork that African Americans, you know, the pain that they have borne, the struggles that they have gone through, you know, paved the way for us, you know, to have the rights that we do. And I'll always be grateful for that. You know, it's like they were out there marching for equal rights so that we could have equal, you know, rights. That we could marry whoever we wanted to, regardless of their skin color, that we could vote, that we could have all these things. So I think, you know, Indian Americans, you know, people of color and just owe a great debt to that, to African Americans for what they've done before us. So speaking of, you know, the model minority, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, everybody, you know, it's funny because my family, I would say, if you looked at it on paper, fits that. It's like my dad, you know, we moved here from Africa. My mom was a school teacher. My dad worked really hard and, you know, I became a TV writer. And see, America works. But what they don't see is how hard my dad had to work, you know, how tough it was, the things that he had to endure in order for me to have the things that I had, you know. And Model Minority is, I don't know, I just, it's because they want to keep you in a box. They want you to shut up, you know. They want you to shut up and keep quiet, let us have our privilege, and then maybe someday you'll make enough money that, you know, we'll let you into the club. And yeah.
Yeah, and I think that sums it up beautifully, because I think that's a portion of the angst that's happening right now, especially in middle America. I mean, some of it is economy related. I mean, you know, the advent of technology is making it harder for certain jobs that were taken for granted are now disappearing. And so there's definitely that element of things. So I don't want to make this an entire discussion that this is all race relations.
Sure.
There's other elements in play as well, no doubt. But I do think part of the angst is just that, where, you know, for the longest time, it was, okay, everybody else, you just kind of, here's your place, just stay in your place. And I think what's happening now, partially, is enough people who are not of color, people of color, enough people of color are gaining power and gaining influence. And it's scaring white people to some degree. I mean, I can't quantify the level of that, but this is the feeling I have, that there's a fear now of like, wait, you're no longer in your place. What do we do? How do we handle things?
Right, because they're being at the top of the food chain, top of the totem pole, right?
Right.
So now that, you know, other people are starting to come up, they're power base is threatened. And I think that's what has really given rise to people like Trump. You know, it's this fear of, we're losing control, you know, we're losing, we were always the top, at least we could make, you know, at least the brown and black people were subservient to us in a lot of ways, so that we could feel superior. But now that's changing. So it's, you know, people with power don't want to lose power, and they will fight to keep it, and they will. And I would like to think these are the death throes of it, but it's going to be a struggle, because the thing that Trump's presidency has revealed, or I don't know if it's revealed it, but it's made it okay for people that have these, you know, racist beliefs to be open about it. Mm-hmm. You know, they probably always existed. I didn't realize it was 40% of the country, which is terrifying in itself. But the Trump presidency has allowed them to, you know, fly their colors openly. And it's okay to be racist. I mean, that's sort of the message that they were, you know, he seems to be giving them. It's okay to have these horrible prejudices against people. And that is, that's a terrifying thought.
Okay, I'm going to make an observation. I'm going to say something that's strictly what I think is observation. It's not an opinion. It's not, I'm not trying to classify anything. And it's kind of a response to what you just said. I do think possibly that even of that 40%, there's a decent chunk of people in that subset that believe they're not racist. And I think it's because of what they believe the definition of racism to be. We are not on the same page of what racism means. Racism to you and me is a lot different than racism to somebody that's on the Trump camp. Some people, and again, this is not an excuse or defense. This is why I just think is happening. I have a feeling that there are people within the Trump camp that say racism is when I literally call a black person the N-word.
Yeah.
And if it's not that, it's not racism.
Right.
Right.
They have a very narrow definition of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's got to be explicit. Like I can't make fun of an Asian person's eyes. And as long as I'm not doing that, I'm not racist.
Right.
Right. Right. And I think that's part of the problem why we're having this struggle right now is because we're not on the same page of what is truly racist. There are subtleties that people like you and me experience and see and understand that they don't see and believe understand.
Sure. Sure.
I agree. That's a huge part of the struggle. And I don't know how to break that impasse.
Yeah. I wish I had the answer for it. The only thing I think is education, and it starts at it starts in the schools. But now that the ways the schools are being gutted, and Trump wants to introduce this patriot indoctrination system, that's something straight out of North Korea or deep communist China. I mean, that's right. It's insane. He doesn't want real history to be taught, like how slaves were really treated, it's all so frustrating and maddening. Like, I never thought that in my lifetime I would ever see something like this in the United States. And I will say this, it's like, because, we're talking about all the things that are with America that are problems right now. But for me personally, I mean, I have a deep love for this country. And I think America has the potential. That's what it is. It's all about potential to achieve what the, words of the Constitution, say, to get us to a point where we can perfect the union. And it's going to be through struggle. And it's going to be through pain. And the thing that I've always been proud of is America always seems to make improvements. And the improvements may come not as fast as we want them to, but they do come. And, now we're in a time of crisis. And this is the only time I've ever gone, oh, my God, we've really just stalled. We have, this could take us back so many years, but I really believe in the idea of America. And what we're talking about is making it so that everybody has to live up to its promise, of equality for everybody, that everybody has a fair shot, that everybody is treated, that we're all on the same playing field. And that's, I think, all anybody really wants.
Right.
A fair chance.
You said you came here in 1970?
Yeah, yeah.
What country did you come from?
I was born in Nairobi, Kenya.
Okay.
And so
it's interesting. I want to tie that back to something you said earlier about, the work that was put in by African Americans ahead of us. And I don't know if you coming from Africa, it might be a different or not, but you could maybe share some insight. One thing I always come across in terms of a discussion, and this particularly applies to the friends of my mom, who, I'll be honest, a lot of them have issues. There's forms of racism amongst them as well.
No, of course.
They'll have their derogatory statements towards African Americans, towards Hispanic Americans, Latin Americans, what have you. And to which I always remind them, you guys came here in the late 60s, early 70s, and the only reason you're allowed to come here is because of the Civil Rights Act of 1965. That opened the door for Indian, immigration here. And, it's baffling. They just dismiss that. Whatever. They have no context.
They don't understand how. Exactly.
And the fact that they were able to build it, and despite the struggles that they had, and we all know that they had struggles in the 70s and 80s. Despite that, they were able to build this life that people like you and me are now able to, you know, reap the benefits of. I mean, the things I am able to do now, I obviously could not have done had it not been for what my mom and dad went through. I mean, my dad came here in 1969. The jobs, I mean, he was, my dad had a master's degree in engineering from San Diego State. And his first job out of college was out of grad school, is as a taxi driver.
Wow.
And my dad was dark. I mean, he was about 3-4 shades darker than I am.
Yeah, no, I get it.
And in the early 70s.
Sure.
And, you know, they're not going to take him seriously, you know, because not only is he dark skinned, he has an accent and he's got big bushy hair.
And a funny sounding name.
And a yep. funny sounding name. He's got a thick stash. Like, everything about him was like, how it's like, if I was going through what he went through 50 years ago, would I have survived? I don't know. Would I have given up? Would I have thrown the towel? I mean, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I can't relate to that. But and that's why I chuckle when I hear that a lot of my parents' generation that are now in their 70s and 80s, and it's almost as if they forgot the struggle. They forgot the world they lived in.
Yeah. It's like the reason we left Africa, it was like during the time when, you know, Kenya had just gotten its independence. And so there was a high rise of black nationalism in Kenya. So everybody that wasn't, you know, black African was considered like a second class citizen. Mm-hmm. So especially Indians. My dad he's Indian, but he was born in Africa. My dad considered himself African, actually, or Kenyan. And, but it was like he was taken out of the job that he had, and his role and his position was going to be given to black African. And it, simply because my dad was Indian, right? And so there was a whole thing about, so it was, you know, I understand it politically why they were doing it, but having it done to you does not feel very good.
Right.
You know, so facing that, my dad was like, you know, I'm not going to have my kids grow up in this kind of environment where, you know, even though we were born here, we're not treated well. And so we left, you know, we had the opportunity to come to, you know, there were several different places we could have gone. We could have gone to the UK. We could have gone to Australia, Canada, you know, we applied for visas all over the place. And the visa that came in was for the United States. And we were taken in, we were sponsored by this this minister, this Pentecostal minister. And this is the thing, this is one of the great things of, you know, about America. It's like this family was so kind to us, Pimo. This family helped my dad, you know, get a job, and they, you know, it was like through the church, and they were very, very kind to us. And I will never forget that because I think America at its best is such a generous country. Like when we were at our best and we are welcoming people, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Well, my dad had a similar experience. So he came here in, like I said, in 1969. He had a few options. He was here on an education visa, student visa. And there were three schools he was looking at, BYU in Salt Lake City or in the Utah area, right, in the state of Utah, University of Hawaii, mm-hmm. and in San Diego State. Those were the three schools that he was going to get his master's in. And the school that worked out for him financially, with they gave him the most amount of aid, was San Diego State. So he would go from, at the time, Bombay, ended up in San Diego on a flight, the flight from Bombay to San Diego had a stopover, and apparently there was a delay on the stopover. And there was a family waiting for him in San Diego. It was similar to your situation. It was a host family through a church that had agreed to house him. Right, for a few weeks, whatever, right? Anyways, his flight ends up being the last plane to land at San Diego International on this day. And the airport's empty. The family that was supposed to be there waiting for him had went home because the flight wasn't there. And this is 1969, so you don't have cell phones.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah. My dad's like, all right, I'm here all alone at the airport. There's only apparently only the only other person he saw there after the dust settled and everybody left was a janitor. That becomes important in a second. So he's like, all right, let me try to call this family. So he goes through his bags and he realizes he left the number for the home in India.
Oh, geez.
He just can't go back and get it. It's halfway around the world.
Right.
So, and then he realizes he's not only that, but if he did have the number, he didn't have 10 cents to pay for the phone call at the phone booth. Right? So while he's figuring it out, he's like, all right, well, I remember the name of the person that was supposed to pick me up. So he goes to the phone book, finds the name in the white pages. But he still has a problem of like, well, where do I get my 10 cents to make the phone call? Well, he turns around and he sees a janitor there and says, hey, Mr. Janitor, can I borrow 10 cents? Make a phone call. The janitor lends him 10 cents. And he's able to make the phone call. And the family came to pick him up. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. They brought him into their house. They set him up at school. They gave him his first job. It was a job as a dishwasher at a diner, and the job lasted one day because when he put his first round of dishes in the dishwasher, he would put the glasses right side up.
Oh, jeez.
They would fill up with water, and he was literally fired at the end of his first day. Well, I mean, talk about a rough start to being in a new
country. That's a tough start, yeah. That's
right?
Tough.
I mean, you lose a phone number, you don't know if you're going to make it, and you lose your first job, and you know, you barely know English, and you know, and that was his start. And he would then go on to again to bring back the quote unquote model minority thing. You know, he would start off as a taxi driver in LA as his first job. He lived in a one bedroom apartment in Hollywood. The owner of the building, the tenant or the landlord of the building, had given my dad. He was tired of owning it. Said, here, take this building. It's yours. So he gave my dad the apartment building.
And oh,
he used that. He used that one seed effectively to build his empire, right?
That's amazing.
And then he's juggling both being an engineer and being a businessman. He would build apartment buildings. He would run restaurants. He would run laundromats. I mean, he had a nice little business going for him on top of working as an engineer. We had a nice house, raised two kids, put them through school. I ended up going to UCLA and my sister ended up going to UCLA. I went to law school and my sister went to med school. On paper, like just like your family, we look like the quote unquote model minority. Right. And I think, but I also think to limit us to just that, like, oh, we just played by the basic rules, I think takes away so much of our story.
No, yeah, exactly. It's yeah, you paper the you know, people try to paper that away. And it's like you can't. It's like there are so many injustices, I'm sure, that my dad suffered, you know, when he he would tell me, like, when, like, the British were in Africa and he would be walking down the street with his friends, they would have to step off the sidewalk and walk in the gutter while the white folk walked by. Tell me those stories. And I would, you know, living in America, I was like, how is that even possible? I don't even understand this. This is insane. Like, how did you, you know, why didn't you punch him in the face? All that stuff. not really kind of realizing the ramifications of that. But yeah, my parents were very, it was very similar. It's, you know, my dad was, he worked with his hands. So my dad was a forklift driver. He was a warehouseman. So he worked in a, he did hard work. You know, he was a real hard hat and lunch pail kind of guy, literally. And I just remember too, I mean, like the things that my dad had to do, like I remember one time, you know, the car broke down or something. He would hitchhike to work. He would do, I mean, just whatever it took to like make it happen, you know. And my mom, you know, my mom had 2 degrees. She was a teacher, but she didn't want, she didn't really want to teach American kids because she felt they were too unruly. And this was back in the 70s, so
can't imagine now.
You know, it's a huge difference. You know, those British schools, right, in Africa, were very, you know, everybody behaved very, it was a whole thing. So, but my, you know, my mom got a job, so I was a real latchkey kid. But it was, we had a lot of structural, I think, advantages too. Number one, you know, my mom was an English teacher, so we all spoke perfect, you know. I spoke better English than kids I went to school with. Wow. You know, the only thing I kept saying was Z that was different. Instead of Z, I'd say Z.
Yeah.
But, you know, and our family name was Francis, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't have an odd-sounding name. It was always... And we were Christians, so we went to the same churches. So that, I think, helped my family integrate much, you know, it made it smooth. But there were still, again, there was just a lot of, you were always, you know, the Indian kid, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and here it's like, okay, the things I went through growing up were nowhere near what my dad, your dad, and your parents had went through. But that doesn't mean we haven't had our own fair struggles. I think the only thing we had going for us, at least for me, is we had the forum to say something back.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't have to take it, right? I mean, even today, let's talk about right now, this very moment. As much as we're talking about the Trump era and the climate we're living in, the fact that you and I could sit here on a Saturday morning, now Saturday at noon, and have this conversation says a lot about the world, that the luxuries, that privileges that we do have, that you know, we can still do things and we don't have to take it. But I do recall one moment. This is a little anecdote from, I want to say 1991, maybe 92, either sophomore or junior year of high school. And I was at school and I was visiting my history teacher on a break. I think it was lunch break. And for some reason, I want to go ask my history teacher a question during this time. And so he was not in his classroom. He was in a classroom across from me, which was run by another history teacher. And so I walk in, they're both chit-chatting. Now, my history teacher, I remember, was being really cool. He was very hip at the time. He knew how to talk to us, relate to us kids. But the other teacher had a reputation for being a racist. I mean, that was kind of his MO. We all talked about it. I never had him as a class, as a student, but mm-hmm. I've heard stories. And his name was Mr. Wallace. My teacher's name was Mr. Johnstone. And so I walked into Mr. Wallace's classroom. This is the first time I had ever interacted with him, ever. Mr. Wallace. And so I asked Mr. Johnstone my question. We had a quick 2-minute chat and I'm ready to walk out. And at this time, I don't know if I've told you this, but at this time I was not going by the name Parimal. I actually went by a name, which is your middle name, Paul. Mm. That's what I went by in high school. And so the teacher, Mr. Wallace, asked me, like, Paul's not an Indian name. I'm like, no, that's not my real name. That's just my you know, my street name, so to speak, right? My real name is Parimal. And he's like, oh, where is that from? Like, is that an Indian name for real? Like, yeah. And then
For real.
Well, yeah. Oh, no, wait. This next line is going to really get you. So at the time, this is in Cerritos. This is in the city of Cerritos, by the way, which is a melting pot. It's at this time, living in Cerritos, there was no majority. It was a minority majority city, right? So it's a melting pot of a bunch of cultures in the city, right? Even my high school, I think the highest group of one people was 30%. So it was a mixture of everybody, right? And Cerritos is an LA County city. And at the time, the sheriff of LA County is Lee Baca. And reason I say that is because Mr. Wallace had said, you know, I was listening to a speech by Mr. Lee Baca yesterday, and he says the only good Indian is a dead Indian.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, he said that to me.
My God, what a major.
And I'm like 15-ish.
15, oh my 16. God, like what do you even say to that?
And that's what I was like. I was like, my jaws literally dropped, and I started staring at him. And then I looked at my teacher, Mr. Johnstone, and I'm like, I gave him a shrug, like, what the fuck? What is this? And he didn't know what to say. Because he just frowned. He's like, I don't know how to defend you right now because that just sucks. And I remember going
That's
home.
That's horrible. Good Lord.
Oh, yeah. And I remember late, I can't remember if it was that day or the next day. I'm in the car with my family. We're driving home from dinner. We went to dinner. Driving home, and my dad had said something about Lee Baca. He had said something. My dad was embedded in politics. So he had watched the news, and he had said something about Baca, said which he disagreed with. I'm like, yeah, you know, Dad, yesterday this teacher had said to me that, you know, he paraphrased Lee Baca saying the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And my dad, all his veins just burst. He's like, okay, tomorrow I'm going to school with you. We're going to talk to this teacher. My dad was pissed.
Oh, I can.
And rightfully so. I was pissed too. I didn't fully understand things, and I was pissed. And I had no problems. And that's what happened. The next day, we went to school and we complained. And I stood my ground, and my dad stood his ground. And, you know, the matter, I guess, when it resulted in an apology, you know, eye roll. And that was all we got out of it. But
at least you said something. I mean, that's the, you know.
Well, you know, what's sad is that there were continued anecdotes of other statements made by the same man as days went on, even after this. So I was not the first. I was not the last. Right? And that's what troubled me. It still troubles me to this day.
It's amazing because it's, you know, everybody thinks of California as a very progressive, I mean, state, and it is. But there are certain pockets that are just as, you know, conservative as, like, deep red, you know, Alabama.
Right. Oh, I remember in my second year of college, I had a sociology professor who said, once you go drive east of Riverside, you're out of Disneyland.
Yes.
And his point was, you know, there's actually a significant stretch of California that is no different from the South. You could go, for example, one city that comes to mind is Bishop, California, which is in near Mono Lake. It's 3 to 4 hours away from any city of any kind. I mean, 3 to 4 hours away from Bakersfield. That tells you something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And you drive there, you visit the stretch of the what's called the Eastern Sierras. It's the eastern part of California that's not quite Nevada yet. And it's so rural. It's so sparsely populated. Good luck finding anybody of our skin tone that isn't also on a farm or in the farms working, right? I mean, you go anywhere, it's just – and that's, you know – From that point east until who knows when, you see a lot of that. I mean, I was in Wyoming a year ago, and I mentioned this in my last episode. Same similar situation where I was in Cheyenne, the largest city in Wyoming, and I was the only non-white person I saw in town.
It's a real thing. You know, I have to say, it was interesting, like growing up in Livermore, like I did, which is a small town in the Bay Area. And back then it was, you know, very small. It was a pretty much a cow town. I mean, it still has a rodeo. But what was interesting is, and it was conservative, but what I did not, this is just me personally, I didn't experience a lot of racism or any racism, I think, from my peers. I think it just wasn't a thing. And I think it was because of, again, this kind of the structural sort of advantages that I had of, you know, speaking English and blah, 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 blah. But also, it was, there weren't very, like, we were one of one or two Indian families that lived there. So I think people looked at us more like a curiosity than as a threat. And my high school experience was actually, you know, pretty good. I mean, like, growing up, nobody like, there was no real racial component to it, I mean, at least towards me. And it wasn't until actually that I went to college that's when it became a thing. Like, that's when I was like, holy shit, there are people that are, you know, that started seeing me completely different. Because in my friend group, that it just wasn't a thing, you know. And I was kind of very fortunate in that way, you know, for my early years to have that happen. And I don't know if it was just particular to that town, but I swear, though, Pima, when I got to college, it was a whole different story.
Yeah, no, and I think we all have stories we could relate to on that note. I mean, even though I had my incidents in high school and earlier, I think, you know, like I said, growing up in Cerritos at the time I did, I was exposed to a lot of different cultures and ethnicities and races. And I don't think it was until law school for me that I started to really see the realities.
Yes.
And that's not to say I didn't see it earlier. I mean, I did spend a few years living in South LA.
Yeah.
I had a lot of black friends who were gangsters. I had a lot of Mexican American friends who were gangsters. And I saw the interactions that they had with the police. So it wasn't that I wasn't exposed as a kid. I saw it as a kid. But I didn't understand the grand structure.
Yeah, you didn't. Yeah, you don't know how to quite process it. Yeah,
right. It wasn't until law school that I started putting it together,
this is messed up.
Right, right, and that's when I started to understand the system of like, whoa, this isn't just isolated situations I'm seeing. There's actually a system here in place, and that's I take that back to the comment I said about my podcast from a couple of days ago was, the system is broken, and this is the first step we have to all take is we have to, the only way we want to me, and this is to kind of wrap things up today, to me, the only way we're going to make progress from today as a community, as a people, is if we admit that the system is broken. We have to accept that as fact.
Yes.
That could no longer, for as long as that is a debate, for as long as we keep debating that, system is broken. No, it's not. As long as the debate persists, the world that we live in will continue, and it'll magnify and get worse. And so now the next step is, how do we come to that agreement? I think we need leadership.
Yeah.
Trump is not the right leader for that, obviously. No. I don't even think Biden's the leader for that. He's a better step than what we have now. But we need somebody on a national level that's a far greater leader than we've ever seen in order to get that message across. I think that's the first step we need to make. We need to find that person.
I think what needs to happen first, I disagree a little bit. I think Biden is the right person for this particular moment.
I don't agree with that. I will agree with that, yes.
And I think that he is going, I think, because of what's happening in this country, I mean, he, first of all, we need to get the car out of the ditch, right?
Yes.
and, you know, put out the fire and, you know, yes. at least get some base level of what we consider acceptable behavior.
Yes.
And I mean, and Trump is a proto-fascist or a fascist or a is certainly an authoritarian. And I've never seen anything like it in my life in the United States. Like, we have a president saying, I'm not going to leave office. I'm not going to accept the election results. And I'm just going to hang out here for as long as I want. It's like, it's unbelievable that a president would say that he's not going to leave office. So, you know, getting rid of him first, I think, is the appropriate measure. But then you're right, because I view Biden as a transitional president.
Mm-hmm. And that was my point. That's the point I was making.
He's transitioning. And you know, what's great is, you know, it's interesting for us, I think, is we have the first person of Indian descent that is up for vice president. Right. And that says a lot. It's you know, it's really, I was surprised how much that affected me when it actually happened.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's similar. I mean, you know, I'll be the first to admit I wasn't the big, and I'm still not the biggest Harris fan.
Sure.
I have my issues with her as a politician.
Sure.
That said, the day I watched her speech at the convention, and I will admit there were tears that were coming out of my eyes because I felt happy. For one, generally felt happy. I liked what she had to say. And then just the fact that she was representing me and my people.
Yeah.
Right. Because I do one thing, even though I'm American born and I am an American, I do take my roots very seriously.
Sure.
Right. I feel a connection to India despite not being from there. It is where my family's from. I speak a language from there. I eat the food from there. I practice the cultural mores. I mean, there are elements of me that are Indian. It's part of the duality of being an Indian American, right?
Yeah.
And even I'm a little bit of both. And to have somebody potentially on a national scale in the White House that represents the part of the world where my roots go to, you can't help but feel some level of pride for that happening.
Well, absolutely. You feel like you're being seen and you're being validated, that your experience is being validated.
Right. And if I could put a twist on that, I don't want to say this in a blanket statement, because there are, to be fair, Indian American politicians who I'm even less of a fan of. And I'm not
sure. Oh, me too. Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not sure if the same emotions would be evoked, like if Nikki Haley,
Nikki Haley or Bobby Jindal was like,
right? Yeah. Would I feel the same pride? I doubt it.
I don't think. I think I'd feel embarrassment.
or Bobby Jindal, even worse, right?
Even worse. It's like, yeah, Nikki Haley. Every time she opens her mouth, I'm just like, oh,
stop it. I said this on a previous podcast during the Republican convention when she said, America's not racist. And, oh, by the way, my dad endured racism. How do you say both those things in the same breath?
I don't know. There's just a level of denial that's going on there that I don't know. I mean, honestly, I just don't get it. I don't understand that. But yeah, it's like, for me, it's like, you know that guy Dinesh D'Souza, who's
yes,
that real,
yes,
like, I want to strangle that guy.
It's like,
stop it, you're making us all look bad.
wasn't he convicted of fraud or
something? Yes, yeah,
there was some, like, really serious charge that he was tried and convicted of, and then he was pardoned by Trump.
Yeah, exactly.
What in the actual fuck?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So with Kamala, it's definitely a sense of pride and a sense of like, wow, because she reminds me just physically in appearance of my sister. My sister kind of looks like her. Uh-huh. And, you know, so I have this real sort of like, you know, and we're both from the Bay Area, you know, there's that real, you know, I grew up in the East Bay. She's from the East Bay. And so I feel I really love, but like when I see people like Jindal and Nikki Haley, I'm just like,
It is great. The other person, oh, why am I blanking his name again? I did this last time. He was the guy who founded Sun Microsystems. And he's also from the Bay Area. He lives in Silicon Valley. And he bought this piece of property near Half Moon Bay. I want to say it's either in San Mateo County or possibly Santa Cruz County. And this property abuts the beach. It's literally right on the ocean. And the beach, now, I don't know if you know this or not, but under the California Constitution, beach access is a constitutional right. It is a right that every human being in the state has access to. If you are in California, you have a God-given right to access the beach. Any stretch of water, no one can take that away from you. It's under the Constitution, right?
Right.
Now, this property that this guy bought, and he's Indian American, and he's a billionaire. The property he bought, it blocked the beach in such a way that you had to walk through the property to get to the beach. Now, the previous owner, who had owned it for like decades, had allowed people to walk, basically take a very specific path through the property to get to the ocean. Because again, it's consistent with the law, right? This guy buys a property and decides to chain up and lock up that path and says, if you, California, want to grant property rights or access rights, you have to pay me millions of dollars for it and then make up your money by charging the public for that thing, right? He took this matter to the Supreme Court. Like, that's how far it went to the Supreme Court.
Jesus Christ.
And he's like, well, you know, people have their rights. I have my rights too. What about my property rights? You're a billionaire. What are you talking about?
Shut the hell up, man. Right?
And the Supreme Court laughed at him. They literally, in unanimous, I believe the vote was either 8-1 or 9-0. They refused to hear the case. They didn't even let arguments happen. They're like, yeah, you know what? Bye. This is not a federal matter. California ruled on this and California ruled against him. And like, you know what? The state already ruled and we're going to accept the state's ruling.
Yeah, so peace out. But that's just, it's like you want to see people that I know that, you know, Indian society is not monolithic, just like any, ethnic group in the United States. There are different, you know, and I think Indians in general tend to skew more conservative, at least the older, you know, generation. Right. I think younger generation skews more liberal. But yeah, it's like there's so many, you know, everybody's got their own thing. Everybody's got their own issues and problems. But, you know, it's nice to see somebody like Kamala Harris, who represents, I think, a certain way of being in this world, yep, be nominated. So I'm hoping I can't even think about what happens if they don't win. I'm not allowing myself to go there. So,
well, I don't think, I think it's way too soon to get there. I mean, a lot could happen in the next, 30 to 40 days, which is, I think we're in that zone now, 30 to 40 days.
Yeah, we are. This is the, we're closing in on the end game here, so
we're about a month. I want to say next week it's officially 1 month. By next Saturday it's 1 month away from from Election Day. And just so you know, I found the name. His name is Vinod Khosla.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I'll make a note to avoid that guy if I ever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he literally took his grievance to the Supreme Court, and he got slapped out of town.
Good.
So, yeah. I guess for the immediacy, the message we should walk away from today is be sure to vote. I mean, obviously, we hope enough people vote for Biden and the Electoral College coincides with the popular vote this time. That would be nice. But I think that's in the short term or the immediacy of just as many people as possible need to vote. Because I do believe this, that the higher, and this is actually a handicap of the Democrats, that the higher the voter turnout, the more likely it is a Democrat will win.
Because exactly.
Because the registration numbers tend to favor Democrats over Republicans overall. So we need people to get their vote to have a, not just for Democrats and Biden, but just it's great for democracy to have.
We need to have an act, because that's the thing. We have not participated.
Yes.
The reason we are here is because we have not been great caretakers of our democracy.
Well, let's go back.
Everybody has to participate.
To your point, let's go back to the primaries of 2016. The reason we had Hillary versus Donald in the general election, something like 9 or 10% of the electorate had voted in the primaries.
Yep.
And had more people showed up in the primaries, someone like, let's just be honest, someone like Donald Trump probably wouldn't have made it out of the Republican National Convention.
Yeah.
Had a Ted Cruz or Jeb Bush. And as for all the grievances that we've had against men like them, the situation is so bad right now. I would have taken.
There wouldn't, yeah, it would for a John Kasich, who I would kill for at this point. You know,
yeah, exactly. So you know, it's voter turnout is important. So that's the message of right now. In terms of immediate action, get out there and vote. And once the dust settles, then we could kind of figure out how, depending on the results, we have to figure out what then the defenses are or the path is to get to where we need to get to after that.
Exactly. First step. Yeah.
So we'll end with that. David, personally, where can we find you? If anybody wants to have a conversation with you of any kind, is there a website, a Twitter account?
I don't have a website, but I'm on Twitter DP Francis 1985 on Twitter.
Okay.
You can find me there. DM me if you have any, or just message me.
Sure.
And look out for American Gods when it drops. Do a shameless plug here in early next year. And about it.
Cool. And of course, everybody listening, if you want to continue listen to all of our episodes. This is episode 58. 58 or 59. I can't remember the exact count. It's been so many. But you could find the Asian Highways Storytellers Action Podcast on all of your podcast platforms. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, iTunes. You can find us on Google Play. You can find us on iHeartRadio. So we're all over there. Just search for Storytellers in Action, and you'll find the podcast. Be sure to download, subscribe, and rate. The more ratings and comments and subscriptions we get, the more visible we become, which is great for our guests. And, of course, don't forget to visit our website, ah1.live. You can find a bunch of stories, news stories, sports stories, features, environment, what have you. So we have a ton of stuff for you to read. And also a shameless plug on our behalf, starting yesterday, September 25th, was the LA Asian Pacific Film Festival here in Los Angeles. It's running virtually through October 31st. So be sure to check out that. You go to, I believe it's VC Media. vcmedia.org, and you can find out more information about that. So with that, David, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure having you.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Thank you so much, Pimo.
And we need to make sure it's not another 7 years before we have you again.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. No, we need to get together and hang out.
For sure, for sure. So on behalf of everybody here at the Asian Highway, on behalf of Ferial and Devesh, and on behalf of our guest David, thank you so much for tuning in. This is Storytellers in Action. We'll talk with you next week.